And they had me speaking on the main stage because they, quote, had so much interest in my talk on stress. And so I show up to the main stage, which was this giant auditorium that sat probably 300 people, and nobody was there.
That story doesn't sound like the beginning of an episode on success, does it? But success is merely one face of a coin that we as speakers flip every time we get up there to the front of the room. And we know what's on the other side of the coin, don't we? And we flip it, and we wait. And we hope it lands correctly. But what usually happens, of course, is that it disobeys the laws of physics because it's not a real coin. It's just a metaphor, right? And it lands on its edge, teetering there, tottering there on its tipping point as we hope that the encounter goes well. And we work with our audience to make sure it lands right side up. Today's episode of Every Speaker Has a Story is composed of the tales told by speakers in response to me asking for their story of their greatest success. And none of them is uncomplicated. None of them is simple, which is what I find most inspiring about these stories. It's not like all of us walk up there and genius just emerges from our pores. It's work, it's hard, and these are stories of success well earned. On today's episode, my greatest success of Every Speaker Has a Story. This time, I won't make you wait to the end. Let's let Dr. Kathy Groover finish her story that I call The Empty Room.
I went up to Sacramento to do a book fair, and they had me speaking on the main stage because they, quote, had so much interest in my talk on stress. And so I show up to the main stage, which was this giant auditorium that sat probably 300 people, and nobody was there. Zero. Big goose egg. Except for my sister-in-law, my nephew, and my niece. And I'm in this huge, not like it was a classroom for 20. This was a huge auditorium. And I'm standing up there looking like an idiot, like, ha, you know, and I'm looking around the room as if people are there. But I said to one of the volunteers, she said, can I get you anything? And I said, yeah, you need to get me 20 people. And she goes, okay. And she left. And I thought, I know you're only 19, but I mean, like, what did you say? And she goes, hang on. And about 5 minutes later, she traipses back into the room with 20 people. She went to the volunteer, like, green room and said, I need you guys to come with me. We're going to go hear a talk. So it was this interesting lesson of the show must go on. And my joke is, if the audience outnumbers me, I do the show. That was always our joke in Hollywood, you know, with the doing this crappy black box theater in Hollywood, you know, and you'd have like three friends and like the camera, you know, the cameraman's girlfriend. If the audience outnumbered the cast, we would do the show. And it's only me. So they typically outnumber me. But it was just this interesting lesson, too, in asking for what you need. What do you need? I need 20 people. Okay. And literally she walked me back in 20 people. And they were into it. They loved it. Some of them bought books. I made friends with these people. So it was a really fascinating experience. So it started out being, oh, God, and it turned into this really great lesson.
An empty room would be a pretty challenging set of conditions for success. That coin is definitely teetering on the edge. So you'd think that the opposite problem, a completely full room, would be easier. You'd think. Let's find out from Beth Z, our nerdy best friend.
I know the exact moment. So I finally got a proposal accepted for the American Society, 2012. I knew in my heart that if I nailed it, I could do this. And I was doing about 20 gigs a year. And I was on the last day before the last speaker. And, you know, a lot of people go home and things like that. And I thought it would be me and the guys picking up the chairs. I'm not kidding you. They said, expect 60 to 70 people in your room. And I'm like, okay, that's all right. I got in there and I was known in this community. So it's not like I'm completely what have you, you know, I've been in the association community for a while. Some people knew I was there but this was me by myself. So I go in or I start to go into the room cause there's back to back and I can't get in the room. There are some people lined up. I'm like, what are you guys waiting for? And they said, well, we're waiting for the next session. I'm like, that was me. So I had to move past the people who were lined up to get into my session. There ended up being, they told me 60 to 70. There ended up being 230 people in that room. They were seated on the floor behind me. They were seated cross-legged, just like kindergarten, in front of the screen. They were three deep in the door. And still to this day, gives me chills because I nailed it. I nailed it from the very beginning. The first joke, the entire room lit up. And the last joke, and I didn't get a standing ovation. I'm not really a standing ovation kind of speaker, unfortunately. You can stand after the end of this podcast. That would make me feel
stand
good.
Stand at the top of the screen.
Yeah. but, you know, they left, and I just sat and cried.
Yeah.
I just was like, this just happened. And on my way home from that event, I got 3 gigs. I tripled my business in 1 year. I went from 20 gigs a year to 60 that day. And, you know, they were still in the lower price area, but to this day, I remember that feeling, and I still get it sometimes. Like, oh my God, I can't believe that this just happened, that I was able to do this, that I connected with this many people. One woman came up to me and she said, I skipped my father-in-law's funeral because I wanted to come here. And I said, I am so glad you didn't tell me that before the session because that would have freaked me out.
The tale of the empty room and the tale of the crowded room both ended successfully. Beth and Kathy knew they had been successful because of the response of the audience, both immediately and in the long term. And that's our key metric as a speaker. We know we've done well because the audience will let us know. And of course, for those of us who are nervous about speaking, that's also one of the things that we're worried about. We know the audience will let us know. So if you think about all the ways in which the audience might let us know that we've done a good job, I'll bet you're not thinking about something that happened to Billy Arsamont, telling a tale of a management training speech that he gave in Hong Kong decades ago. We'll call this the tale of the sojourner.
The other event that was really, really interesting to me, when I did the program in Hong Kong, there were about 150 worldwide business leaders at a productivity center. And when I finished my presentation, which was the same one, but a little bit more detailed and flexibility because this was an English-speaking audience, Dr. Henry Lee, remember him, like, I could still see him standing up at the end of my presentation and reading a poem in my honor. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
That, I cannot tell you. I can still see him standing in front of me. And then he sent me a booklet of all of his poems as a thank you gift.
Confession time. I have never once in all these years had an audience member read a poem in my honor after a presentation. So, audience, wherever you are listening to this podcast, if you would like to read a poem in my honor and perform it, I would love to hear that. If you just tag me in social media, of course, then I might ask you to be on the show, so watch out. But in case you don't have any poems to read, and in case the idea of somebody celebrating you with an art form in the audience seems a little distressingly high, an expectation of what to get, Billy had other experiences in China, and he struggled with the idea that he was bringing a message of capitalist leadership to a communist nation. And he was concerned that some of his content might make it difficult for him to, as he says, get out of China. So it wasn't always simple knowing that his greatest success was successful. He didn't always get a poem. Sometimes he got more restrained feedback. And I want to share one other tiny piece of Billy's story.
The reception was amazing. I'm still flabbergasted, and that was umpteen years ago. I got a letter from a professor at Beijing University, and this is the essence of what he said. In another day, in another time, this is a great message. And what he was telling me between the lines was, you know, I agree with this, but I can't do it to the degree that you're suggesting in my environment, at least not now.
Of course, you don't have to go abroad like Billy to find a group that is different than you. A group for whom you might wonder, am I going to be able to bring to them something valuable? Am I going to be able to bridge our differences? And of course, well, this is a show about success, so that you know in the next story, we'll call it the story of the school, that John Donahue Grossman was successful.
I think one that stands out, I was speaking at like a alcohol drug prevention program. Okay. Here in Illinois, we have what's called a snowball snowflake program. I think that's in some other Midwest states, but I was in New Jersey, and it was a tough part of town. And I think I was probably the only white guy in the entire room. And talk about credibility. Here's this white suburban old man coming to talk to middle school kids in a really tough urban setting. I just wasn't sure how that was going to go. And I did my normal talk. I didn't really change much about it. I did my homework, though. You know, I learned about the community they were in. I really picked the brains of people who brought me in to find out what was going on in those kids' lives with their families. So I think I was able to have a sense of where the kids were coming from. Not that I would obviously fully understand, but when I was done with my talk, I didn't think I did a good job right away because it wasn't the normal response I'm used to, right? I'm trained to say, okay, now you applaud, you know, really loud, and maybe you stand up and give me a standing ovation or something. And it didn't. It was kind of quiet. And you know, my heart sunk, you know. And I went up to the adult and said, well, thanks for having me. I hope that's what you're looking for, you know, because now I'm almost like begging for, please tell me I'm okay.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, you have no idea what you just did. And all of a sudden, the kids started coming up. And several of them were crying. And I remember there were a couple middle school kids who asked if they could hug me, and they wouldn't let go. I would hold up as one of the better ones. And I have found often that sometimes some of the better ones are not, they don't go the way I think they're supposed to go. But something happens again. And I, as a speaker, you know this. I mean, we do our part, but there's something happening with them, with us. You know, it's not just us doing something or saying something. Sometimes they're bringing something to it, and sometimes magic happens, and it's nothing you can program. There was magic in the room that day, and I and we all say this, we learn so much by working with certain groups of people. I mean, we gain so much. It's like being a teacher. I mean, you learn so much. But that day it was really, really true. Like, I sat and I had a meal with them afterwards. It was a situation where I didn't have to run, go to the next talk. I could sit down, and that's where I thought, boy, if I could sit down to a meal with the people who, my audience afterwards, you'd learn a lot more of what you really did. Did I just, you know, give these kids a great, you know, break from school, or did something happen in their life that's going to really be talked about for a long time after?
John and his audience were able to bridge their shared cultural gap. But there are lots of different kinds of cultural gaps. As you'll find in the next story, we'll call it The Inventor's Tale. From Julie Austin, who at the time was an inventor and entrepreneur, speaking to what for many of us is the most challenging culture of all, engineers.
It was a huge audience, and it was a big corporation. It was one of the top 10. I was the first woman that they had do this conference ever. And so, and these are for engineers. So scientists and engineers. And I thought, oh my God, that's, you know, I didn't even go to college. So who am I to stand up here and talk to these people? But I was talking about creating intellectual property, which is something I know very well. I had a few stories in there that they were kind of tearjerker stories, and it really spoke to the audience. And I think to look out in the audience and see people cry, you as an actor, that's what you hope for, is that you have touched someone. And I do, and people taking notes, and the management, the whole table of the management team were furiously taking notes. I think those two things made me feel like, okay, I accomplished what I came to accomplish.
You know, I didn't think anything would make me as jealous as Billy's story of getting a poem read to him in his honor in Hong Kong, but Julie's story about making engineers cry, I cannot imagine being as effective as that. I mean, they were all in view of each other, like in public, engineers crying. I mean, I know I have some engineer stereotypes clearly that I need to interrogate, but still, I find that amazing. And so maybe like me, you're thinking, you know, I just don't think I could do these things. These stories are just too much, you know. And maybe this is why I did so many episodes of the show about disasters and horrible things and technical difficulties, because, you know, it doesn't make us feel so bad and jealous. Like these are just impossible to achieve moments. But the thing is, I don't think they're impossible to achieve. And if we could take a step back and think about all the things that these stories have in common so far, it's that that coin landed on its edge and it was teetering. And in each case, the speaker was able to pivot or push in a maybe unexpected direction, and that led to success because all of these speakers pushed at some point and it fell the other way. All of these speakers have a story of failure, and you'll hear those in a future episode. But it's not like, you know, lightning always strikes perfectly for everybody here. It just, it, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And what we can learn from everyone's experiences of when it works is that there are sometimes things we can do to increase our chances of success. And the through line so far, and with the speaker stories to come, is that often it results from a pivot, something unexpected. You do something different. You do something that even maybe you didn't know you were going to do. And that risk is the moment when it begins to shift. So our next speaker is Wolfgang Wolf, who speaks in New Zealand about rehabilitation and disability. Wolfgang himself suffered a stroke, and so he speaks in this story of his success about the challenges that come from when you come onto stage in a wheelchair and people's expectations about what that will mean. And as you begin to speak with a speech impediment, how it is that people are going to respond to you. And, of course, his pivot, his choice here, is fascinating.
I think the answer would be humor, you know, because that's what connects people. And, I mean, obviously, when I go on stage, the moment I come on and people see the wheelchair, they just need it to start with. So consequently, I'm trying to open with something that makes them laugh or at least smile. Now, my greatest success is, again, the humor thing. Now, because I have got that T-shirt made up, and often when I talk to people in the public, they ask me, what can you do about not having a stroke, about avoiding a stroke? And of course, I have risk factors, and I mention all those risk factors and that they obviously should listen to their doctor. And that's the other thing. I had that T-shirt made up, and then I show them the T-shirt and tell them that after the presentation, they can, if nothing helps them, they can get one of those T-shirts they can buy, and that says, shit hems. And I must say that's a success because, as I said before, the negative thing or the seriousness of the subject, suddenly there's this human aspect to it, you know. I mean, I don't really sell that T-shirt. I had only one made up, you know, for that presentation. But yeah, that worked very well.
As Wolfgang's experience in the story of the shirt indicates to us, humor is often a great way to pivot through complex moments. But there are other ways to pivot, as Angelica Mata, a social media coordinator and former trainer at Apple's story indicates to us, that sometimes, you know, something besides humor, sometimes just pure nerdiness is all that we need in the story of the nerds.
I actually love telling this story. So most of my public speaking has actually come out of being a corporate trainer and doing training also to the general public on I worked at Apple, so most of the stuff that I was doing for the general public was centered around use of their machines and the softwares that were on there and how to get the most out of their iPhoto or what have you. And the corporate training, from the corporate training perspective, I was training people how to train other people. So it's kind of funny, just training the trainer. But there's this one class that I have, and I just laugh thinking about it. We were having a conversation about whether or not individuals have to be a master of theory behind something in order to be able to teach others. Right. I think that's the idea of the whole Socratic method, is that you can teach anybody without having any expertise in a particular subject. It's the idea of extracting the knowledge from somebody else to get them to come to the conclusion on their own, that the knowledge already exists within, that the person who is asking the questions is the one that's really kind of helping them connect the dots. Anyways, so we're in this class and we're talking about mastery, and they weren't connecting the dots. And I just so happened to be in a class filled with a bunch of people who played WoW and Dungeons and Dragons, and I have never in my life played either of them. This is where I thank God for South Park. Because the thing that I remembered in that moment was, oh, I know, they went, and how did they level up to level 80? And wow, when they played, well, they went out to the forest and they killed a bunch of hogs. And I'm like, this is perfect. So here I am in this class, and we start having this conversation about playing WoW and not having to be an expert in raids or anything of that sort, that they could go out and kill a bunch of hogs, and how that somehow was crazy related to mastery. It was insane. And honestly, it's for sure one of the most the most prominent memories that I have speaking. But to go back to what we were talking about earlier about like thinking on your feet and having to have that immediate thought, like, oh, okay, I know exactly how to get the conversation back on track or get myself back on track, and whatever it is that I'm presenting, it really is a lot of just thinking on your feet. But I think also in that particular experience, the other thing that was really important was, if I wasn't listening to the things that they had been saying for the days prior, I would not have been able to actually pull that out and tie those two together for them. It just wouldn't have happened.
When the speech is at its tipping point, you pivot to give it a shove, you tell the right joke, you know, you make the right nerd culture reference. Sometimes it feels like natural and easy. Remember, of course, that these are the great stories from these speakers, and everyone I've interviewed for the show also had stories of failure, so it doesn't always work this well. I'm just giving you the good stuff. At the same time, though, sometimes those pivots really, really, really are hard. And for our final story of a greatest success, ironically, this is not a story that Brian Rutberg, the communication and leadership consultant who we're going to hear from in a second, this was not one of the stories he told in his list of greatest successes. This was, in fact, a story of a difficult moment, a challenging moment. And the more we talked, the more it became clear to me, at least, that this, in fact, was his greatest success. And so, in lots of ways, I think for a lot of us listening who are like, okay, you know, sometimes I can pivot, but what about when it gets really scary? So our final story, the tale of the challenge, you can see how it feels when it gets scary, and how you might be able to pivot like Brian.
The first story is simply when I was in front of a group not too long ago, and I began the seminar by having everybody get on your feet. Didn't introduce myself. I was introduced by the HR lead who had brought me in for the day. But I didn't introduce myself. I purposely started with a bang so that the audience could experience what I would want them to do if they were taking the stage. Everybody get on your feet. let's do some vocal exercises to get ourselves ready for speaking. Let's do some physical exercises. And I taught some of the power positions, Amy Cuddy, TED Talk, right? And those have been revealed as at least controversial. I wouldn't use the word debunked, but one of Amy Cuddy's co-authors has come out and said, yeah, not sure how replicable that is. And we ended up being – and one of the people in the room was aware of the scientific controversy around power positions. In a friendly way, challenged the teaching. Now, it worked out nicely for me because I had a couple of slides for this audience that not only talked about the psychology behind power positions, but I had built into my remarks the controversy around it and managed to come down on the side of, if you feel like it works for you, the placebo effect is a real thing, you might as well go with it. And besides, you know, we don't know that it doesn't work. You can try it and you can coordinate it with things like third-person self-talk, things like that. So being challenged by an audience and being able to recover, that's probably the worst that I've ever seen.
I think for all of us listening, one of these tales was scarier than the others. You know, and maybe Brian's tale was your scariest one for you. For me, the idea of someone getting up and challenging me in public, is, you know, as a teacher, that sounds great. Like, first, they're awake. Second, they're engaged enough in what's happening to actually speak up and use their voice. I figure, well, the fact that you disagree with me is now a minor thing. We can work with that. You're conscious. Fantastic. Let's go. But I imagine for some of you, that's the most horrifying thing ever. To have that happen would be the worst. And so each of these really has been chosen for this episode out of all the success stories from all the dozens of people I've interviewed for the show, because they express this diversity of approach that for all of us, there's something scary about speaking, for sure, but there's also something fantastic about being able to successfully listen and make that pivot and do something cool. And for some of these speakers, and for some of the ones who haven't been on the show yet, who I've got reams of audio waiting to go, for those of you who have yet to call me and tell me you want to be on the show, there's something about that scary moment when you can make a real connection and a real impact, and or you couldn't. There's something about that moment that we like, which is why we keep doing it. And so if you're a professional speaker, you know this feeling. If you're an amateur speaker, if you're just learning in class, you don't necessarily know this feeling. But I would suggest that to have a greatest success like this, you have to open yourself up to that risk just a little bit. In some ways, the worst that could happen, you know, the wrong room, the challenge, all sorts of things. We've heard people manage them. Give yourself a chance to try to manage that moment. In other words, if you're going to fail, fail awesomely. Because then even if you do fail, it's a great way to learn. So with your indulgence, I want to share with you a tiny bit of my greatest success, which would be when I spoke at TEDx in San Antonio. Ever since I was younger, I'd had a trouble with coming up with exactly what I wanted to do in the conclusion of a speech. I remember driving to my first Lions Club student speaker contest in high school with my teacher, Mr. Hufford, and I was talking through my conclusion with him in the car as we were parking, because I just have a hard time, I have a hard time letting go. As you can tell by now, as I'm spinning the end of this podcast out into the future, I have a hard time figuring out what's going to be the thing that's going to work. As I've discovered in writing The Zombie Guide to Public Speaking, my textbook, it's really, really easy teaching students how to make introductions. You can have a list of different options, but conclusions are hard. They're idiosyncratic. And in some cases, I think my reluctance has been because I'm a secret genius. I'm probably not supposed to admit that out loud, especially on a show that people are listening to, that you don't know how to end something until you meet them. And you know what they need, you know? So that's the part of me that's justifying my procrastination. But anyway, I remember that with Mr. Hufford, and I remember going on stage before TEDx. They had a screen behind a screen behind a screen. I went behind the farthest screen. Like, there was gaffer-taped cables everywhere, and I was afraid I was going to, like, trip on something and unplug the speaker before me. And I was in there in the dark where there wasn't a chance that any of the people milling around backstage would see me, because I need a moment to myself before I get on. I think most speakers have this kind of moment. And I was sitting there thinking, okay, here you are. There's 650 people out there. This is going to go on YouTube. This is your shot. And your conclusion sucks, dude. You know, I knew I was going to say something. I knew how I was going to wrap everything up. So that wasn't what was missing. What was missing was something that popped, something that felt good that was going to happen, you know? And so I was back there and I was thinking over everything that had happened earlier that day. And I was thinking about lunch that I'd had out there with the 600 people as we all were in a flock trying to wait for tacos and all this kind of stuff. And so I was thinking about all those moments, and I can't tell you exactly how this came out, but the key to the end of the speech, which my friend Wesley has suggested is sort of a mixture between a professor and like a preacher. I don't know. That sounds like a lot. But anyway, that moment that I'm going to play for you just a snippet of now came 3 minutes before I went on. As Victor Landa was heading up to the stage to introduce me and talk about my shoes, this was happening in the back of my head. And, you know, it's of course stressful. It's of course potentially prone for disaster, and I wouldn't suggest winging the conclusion next time you're on video. But for me, it was the only way to feel connected with the room in a way that worked. And so for me, this is how I make my ability to pivot. And so I guess the question would be, how are you going to find yours? What do you need to set up to make yourself nimble enough to give yourself the chance to have a greatest success? Here's a couple seconds of mine.
It's a magical act to have somebody click like on their phone, in their brain, in their notes. It's magic, and we don't often recognize that. So before we open our mouths or our email or our Twitter app, I want us to think about how we can share more. Otherwise, we're really just wasting each other's time. Share more. Thank you.
The formula for your greatest success as a speaker is unique to you. It's a secret formula that only you and your audience know. And you have to be able to adapt and pivot into it. And the thing that we've learned from all of our speakers sharing their stories today is there's a certain kind of willingness to take the risk to be able to make that adaptation when you need to. And if you're not opening yourself to that risk, to that potential for failure, to that connection with the audience, it's going to bring not just a, it was okay, I did the speech I wanted, but a success. You have to be able to open yourself up to something scary. I'm not asking you to wing your conclusion or anything like that, but I'm asking you to be thoughtful that sometimes what you're afraid of is exactly the thing that you need to do. And public speaking is a place where that risk, at least sometimes, is going to pay off. That's it. Another episode of Every Speaker Has a Story. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to the speakers who shared their stories. Thank you to all the speakers who've interviewed with me and have yet to appear on the air. Your time is coming. Just wait. I want to thank everybody who's been so helpful in the last couple weeks in working on the show with advice and ideas. Tucker, Wesley, Pam, Juanita, Marcella, and Michelle. If you have a story that you'd like to share, find me at More Brains with a Z on any social media platform and let me know, and we'll get you an interview set up. It'll be fantastic. Also, on my blog, morebrains.blogspot.com, we've got a feature called Show Notes after each episode where I share video and websites and other information, social media contacts for all of the speakers on the show so that you can find more information about them. Interesting stuff. Please check it out. Thank you again for listening. Thank you again for your time. I know in some ways this has to be the most academically nerdy podcast you listen to, and in a way that doesn't involve spaceships and robots and all the other nerdy things that you like. But I appreciate taking time for fellow nerds on this journey towards figuring out how to communicate with each other. And I'm just glad that I found some people who are also interested in the same thing. So from my studio/office in Langner Hall at Texas Lutheran University in Seguin, Texas, this has been Every Speaker Has a Story. I'm Dr. Steve Roman.